Real quick, before we get into the show, I wanted to share a new service called Getida that Ken and I have been using that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for firing the man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?
But I think in general, the next few months will be a bit turbulent. And I think you're going to see a lot more aggregators going out of business or selling to other aggregators. And the aggregators that are really good at operating will continue to keep on with the mission that they set out to do. And they'll do great. But that's not most aggregators, I'd say. Unless you have a big team, they're totally different business models and they're ran completely different. So I wouldn't really recommend that. Now, if you grew up with doing both, that's great. You have the skill set. But when you're first starting out, I always recommend, like when you first sell a business and you first start buying businesses with that new capital, I always recommend buying what you know first before you go off and explore. We help people sell a business, but ultimately we're there for an entrepreneur through like their entire journey, like whether they're, you know, still in the aspirational phase or, you know, they're like some of my friends who are angel investors now who got their initial funding by selling their businesses with us.
Welcome everyone to the Firing the Man podcast, a show for anyone who wants to be their own boss. If you sit in a cubicle every day and know you are capable of more, then join us. This show will help you build a business and grow your passive income streams in just a few short hours per day. And now your hosts, serial entrepreneurs, David Schomer and Ken Wilson.
Welcome everyone to the Firing the Man podcast. On today's episode, we have the privilege to interview Greg Elfrink. Greg is the director of marketing for Empire Flippers. Empire Flippers is an Inc. 500 company and the number one curated marketplace for buying and selling established profitable online businesses. Empire Flippers has helped customers buy and sell nearly $3 million worth of e-commerce, AdSense, affiliate, SaaS, FBA, and many other revenue generating assets. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me. I hope I'll be able to add some value to the audience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So first things first, tell us a little bit about your story and quick background on your experiences and prior jobs and what led you to Empire Flippers.
Sure. So I have a very stereotypical internet marketing background in that I was an oilfield roughneck in Alaska for 10 years. So almost like the same industry. I hated it, the oil field. I worked in the Arctic Circle, North Dakota, Gulf of Mexico, all over the place, and wasn't particularly good at it. So I didn't like it. So I self-taught myself internet marketing, SEO and content marketing being kind of like my main background. So I ended up joining EF about 6 years ago, leaving the oil field. When I first started, I was just like, you know, a humble blogger. I was just writing the blog posts for the company. And over the years, I have grown to become the head of marketing over here. And I haven't really ever had any other marketing job before this. Tried a lot of different stuff, obviously. Always been a bit entrepreneurial. But yeah, EF was the thing that got me out of the oil field and rocking in the marketing world.
Awesome. Awesome. That's a really cool background. So 10 years up in, that's wild. All right, Ken, over to you. Let's get into this.
Yeah, no, I was thinking the same thing. That's an interesting journey, you know, 10 years in the oil fields and then into marketing, but.
You know, it's funny. So when I got the job, one of the only nice bosses I ever had in the oil field, and I told him I got the job to do marketing. He's like, oh, that's so cool. You always wanted to do that. And since we're a remote first company, like Empire Flippers is a digital nomad company, like they brought me out to Vietnam for training. And so I told him that. He's like, wait a second. Is this real, Greg? Like, what are you doing? I was like, I don't know. I guess I'm going to find out. Just bought the ticket. Oh, yeah.
No, that's cool. Yeah. And so it sounds like it was a pretty good fit because you were kind of moving around and, going, you had mentioned Arctic Circle, Alaska, North Dakota. And so with your previous job, you were kind of moving around quite a bit anyway.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it was because of one job. I kind of like oil feels very feast and famine. Like you're either just like you're working all the time or you're desperate to find something to do. Like it's like there's no middle ground. So I went to the Gulf of Mexico when I was like 18 because That was when one of the first oil crashes happened. So I flew down from Alaska, where I'm from, to Gulf of Mexico. And then eventually I went back up to Alaska and then I quit for a bit. I always had these, like, I don't know, thinking like, I'm never going to do this again, and I'd go do something else. And it would inexorably pull me back in. So during the North Dakota boom in the Bakken area, I went down there, and all sorts of crazy stories there, man. That place was so crazy. I actually was making like 60, 80 grand a year while living on a park bench in front of Walmart, because there was literally nowhere else for me to like stay. So like, I had all my bags and I called every single hotel in town, and they were like, oh no, we're all booked up. And I was like, okay. And this was like around July or something like that. And I asked the hotel I was in, like, okay, when's your next opening? They're like, oh, let me check. Like, looks like January 1st of next year. Cause the oil companies just like bought all the hotels. I was like, oh my God. So I was just like living on park benches in the lobby. I convinced the hotel clerk to let me like stay in his trailer for a few days. And then I met the mayor of Williston, North Dakota, and he gave me a Suburban, which was such a huge boon. Because now I sleep in the Suburban.
Nice. Yeah, that's interesting. Hey, you know, like I said, boom or bust. So, and you made it happen. That's what matters, right? Well, awesome. So you transitioned from that kind of lifestyle into marketing and with Empire Flippers, and I'd like to pivot a little bit into that one. So we're taping the show today is May 9th. This show will probably air like early mid June. Greg, can you kind of go over the current state of the market? You know, if with digital businesses, is it slow? Is it busy? What's changed in 2022?
Sure. So in the last few years, there's been kind of this meteoric rise, especially in the Amazon FBA space. I'm sure a lot of your audience are familiar with the aggregators who have raised, you know, millions of dollars to go out and acquire brands, right? Well, we were one of the first people to serve that market back in, I guess it'd be early 2019, something like that. So over the last couple of years, things have been booming. We've been calling it the season of the seller. Multiples for businesses have never been higher than they are today. But now we're at this very interesting crossroads of with everything that's happening in the world, where a season of the seller might be at its tail end. Like, it's not for sure, but we might be moving back into more of a buyer's market. So it's very interesting to see it happen. Like, some, like the capital markets have slowed down a little bit, and acquisition criteria has gotten a lot more tighter with the private equity aggregators and family offices, which are typically the people buying any seven-figure and up e-commerce stores. So yeah, I would say we're looking like maybe out of a bit of a readjustment, but it's not for sure yet. Things could still come howling back. There's still a lot of aggregators raising money, but that's where the kind of the temperature is at the moment, this state of unsure.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because we've been in a really crazy market the last 12, 18 months. And so, you know, I guess the universe is always shrinking and expanding. And so we're in one of those periods now. So awesome. David, over to you.
So as we talk about the state of the market, I think it's hard to talk about that without the diving deep into the aggregators and what's going on there. Thrasio's made some recent announcements, making some layoffs. So curious on like the next 6 to 12 months, how you see this playing out.
Sure. So a quick funny story. I have a lot of friends at Thrasio and a lot of the aggregators. So I went to my buddy's LinkedIn profile to see if he had mentioned the layoffs that Thrasio announced. And he didn't post anything, but like a few hours later, he messaged me, "Don't worry, I'm still here," because he could see me viewing his profile, right? but yeah, so the things that are happening with the aggregators, this is something I kind of knew would eventually happen. So I'm not surprised by any of this, by any means. And I think anyone who is surprised by it maybe didn't look deep enough into it. It's kind of like, you know, buying Florida swamp land, and you can always resell it and it'll always go higher, all this stuff. So like, it has all the hallmarks of a bubble, right? So like, to analyze what's going to happen, you have to realize like the mistakes that the aggregators made today, where a lot of them are toppling. Not all of them. There's still ones that are doing really good work. But one of the big things is a lot of the aggregators come from this high finance background, and they're really good with M&A, really good with all the stuff, very savvy buyers. But that doesn't necessarily translate into a savvy e-commerce entrepreneur, right? It's not the same skill. They're totally different in a lot of ways. And so a lot of their spreadsheet math, as I jokingly call it, doesn't turn out right when you're actually running the PPC ads on Amazon, actually getting the inventory into the warehouse, all that kind of stuff. So integration is a big issue with a lot of high-end M&A firms or high-end businesses buying other businesses. So that is part of the problem. Another part of the problem is hiring the wrong type of people. So like, they're hiring like ex-Amazonians, all this stuff, like, which makes great press, like in a press release, but like a lot of those Amazonians, they've never ran a startup, right? They've never been in that environment. Amazon has been around for over 20 years, right? It's long past the startup days. So there's all those issues. And then it's compounded by the supply chain crisis that's happening. That's still happening. Like I believe at the time of this recording, at least, I think Shanghai is still underneath the zero COVID policy that's like causing, and I think that's like 20% of exports of China, which is a big deal if you're in e-commerce, right? So there's all those issues. And finally, the big nail in the coffin for a lot of these aggregators is what I mentioned earlier about private capital. So with the capital markets being the public ones taking a huge tumble, and then aggregators failing to report profits like they were supposed to, now the people who are giving them this capital are telling them, like, look, you need to be a lot tighter on what you buy. So a deal that would have sold easily last year is now much more difficult to sell today. So all of that is this confluence of things for the next 6 months, or like why there's all this uncertainty, because aggregators are getting kind of like new marching orders for the people giving them money. But I think in general, the next few months will be a bit turbulent. And I think you're going to see a lot more aggregators going out of business or selling to other aggregators. And the aggregators that are really good at operating will continue to keep on with the mission that they set out to do, and they'll do great. But that's not most aggregators, I'd say.
Yeah. So, Greg, I think, David and I definitely not dumping on aggregators at all, but we had a longstanding discussion between David and I. We always said, it's a lot easier to raise money than it is to operate a business. And so yes. I think, what we saw over the last 18, 24 months was a lot of people really good at raising money and maybe lacking on the operational side. And now it's kind of a pause button and a speed bump and kind of getting the back end figured out. And like you said, the money is the money flowing in, that pipeline is getting tightened up a bit. It's like, hey, well, I want to see some returns for that money that's going in. So interesting. As we kind of translate that, you kind of alluded to it earlier, like the current state of the market, it's kind of switching from a seller's market to a buyer's market. Can you go over kind of what are some of those factors that are, that are impacting valuations and multiples? The aggregator is probably one, but what are some of the other ones, and what are some things that as owner and operators can look at and really kind of, if we're getting ready to go to market in 12 months or so, we can kind of look at these things and kind of evaluate it?
Sure. So the best way to answer that question would be talking a little bit about how valuations in general work, because some people get a bit confused on how valuations work. They see like Uber making a huge IPO or something like that, and they think like, oh, that's like my company, but it's not. Like SaaS businesses in general tend to get a very different valuation than the vast majority of other businesses. So SaaS is typically valued on, say, growth versus, say, like an e-commerce brand would be more valued based on risk. Now, growth is still an element there, of course. But, and I say this because if your audience out there does want to make that exit, like the best thing you can do is make your business as least risky as possible if you want to get the most premium valuation as possible. So that's things like turning off experimental marketing 6 to 8 months before you go to sell. So you're not like losing money, because most marketing loses money until you iterate on it, right? So I'm a marketer saying that, so you know it's real. I've been there. It's very depressing. So like stuff like that, like getting your SOPs clean, your books clean, all that kind of stuff. Things that impact multiples that a lot of people don't consider are things like revenue diversity and traffic diversity. So revenue diversity is like, all right, let's say I have one product in my FBA store. As a buyer looking at a one product business, unless I have a ton of money, that is a very risky proposition for me. Like an $800,000, $2 million, $3 million, one product only business is very risky. Because what happens if the product goes out of style, right? Very similar to traffic diversity. Traffic diversity, if you're only getting all of your sales from Facebook ads, and suddenly your Facebook ad account is suspended, like, well, you might not have a business in a few weeks, right? So that's a big, big, big risk as well. So these are all things that come in with multiples, and things that affect it, obviously demand, buyer competition. And with everything going on in the private capital markets, like I mentioned earlier, that is causing less of that competition forces. So that can actually be a good thing if you're not an aggregator and you're looking at buying a business, because now sellers are kind of looking like, well, who's going to buy this deal? And they might start becoming more open to better deal structures to say, a bootstrap entrepreneur might not have the same kind of funding as an aggregator.
Very nice. Very nice. So, you talked about some of the things that owners should be looking to do as they approach an exit. What about some tips for
you know, operators or investors that are looking to buy? What advice would you give them?
Sure. So if you're brand new to buying, I always tell people to start, you know, small, unless you're, you know, have a good war chest or whatever. You know, I'm a big fan of splitting your budget into thirds. So if say you have, I don't know, $600,000 to spend on a business, buy, like, split that into thirds where you have, you know, $200,000 per bucket, whatever, right? So, and the reason why you want to do that is because your first time you acquire a business, even if you've ran like a successful FBA business, but you've never acquired one, you're probably going to make mistakes, right? That's just natural when we do anything for the first time that we make some kind of mistake. Now, if you use someone like us, we try to prevent that, but it's not like we can prevent all mistakes, right? Especially when you are running the business, like you're off on your own at that point. So I try to get people to think, bake in margin of failure wherever you can. One is on your budget. Also, I recommend having not just acquisition capital, but working capital. So I usually recommend, say, like 20% of money, like whatever the price of the business you're buying, in reserve. And that's very, very useful for your heart when the stressful day comes when like Amazon changes something. Like I had a friend, he sent me a Facebook message a few weeks ago. He's like, I'm screwed. Like Amazon has changed their entire launch policy. My whole launch strategy doesn't work. Like I've never ran an FBA business, but I know exactly that feeling from being an SEO when all my SEO friends say, Google killed SEO because the algorithm changed, right? Like I know that feeling of dread. If you have like some capital in reserves for that like stormy day, that's going to help you a lot because now you have time to think, you have flexibility, you can hire someone to help you. You have a lot more options than if you use all of your budget on the acquisition. I think that's a big mistake for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, that's... And yeah, definitely interesting. And I like how it's, David is definitely on the conservative side in terms of planning and doing that. And so, holding that side, that's, definitely a good model to follow versus being risky. So I like that. A couple of questions are going to pivot a little bit, Greg. You had mentioned, you know, you have some background in the SEO and marketing and publishing. So I'm curious, we've implemented a little bit of AI content into some of our niche websites that are feeding our e-commerce businesses. And as we scale that out, what are you seeing in the marketplace in terms of, well, I guess like the AI content piece and maybe the Google, how do you see that meshing with Google's algorithm in the next 6-12 months?
I think Google will talk a big game on how they can recognize it, but they won't be able to recognize it. And they'll do a bunch of scare tactics like they do to a lot of SEOs to like out them. Like, I don't know if you guys are into SEO enough where you're using some like private blog networks. So like basically like fake websites that'd be linking to your main website. That was a really powerful strategy back in like 2016. But Google did this funny thing where they're like, we know you're using PBNs. And they would target like big companies that were selling PBN links. And that's how they proved that they knew they could do it. But really, they just like found the people using that service and then like got them. And that created a whole wave. But they couldn't actually tell. But people believed it. And then people would like remove a bunch of their PBN links. Like, oh shit, I got to do this before Google finds out. And Google's like, ah, I got you. Like that doesn't naturally happen. So like they like play it into their hand kind of thing. So I think AI content will rise. I don't think it's there yet, but I think it'll become very, very useful. I don't think Google will be able to tell the difference. Or if they can, it won't really matter in the end. Because like as long as it's still valuable, at the end of the day, Google wants their customer, the searcher, to like the content that they're seeing. So if AI content gets so good that it's engaging and valuable, well, that's what Google wants to show people.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, that's, I like that answer. a follow-up question here. And this is something where, with your experience, and you said you've been with Empire Flippers for like 6 or 7 years?
6 years, yeah.
6 years. So you have a wealth of experience kind of handling deals in SaaS and e-commerce and AdSense, FBA, all of these affiliate models. With all of your experience, if all skill sets were equal with an owner operator, which one of those business models have you seen that has like the best return on time?
Best return on time, I'd say content, 100%. I think the earning potential is lower if you do affiliate and display ads versus e-commerce or SaaS. But like I have a friend, he had a website. He sold it not too long ago, a couple of years ago, I guess. But it was doing like 30K a month and he would work like a few hours every other month on it. He's just like a digital nomad out here, like traveling in Asia. And he ended up selling it because like, I can't get it off of my mind. You know, I meet all these entrepreneurs all the time working very little hours, but their mind is just consumed by their business, even so. And that's why a lot of times they come to me to sell. But yeah, I'd say content with display ads and affiliate is probably the best return on your time because you can just leave it there and do nothing. The earning potential, I would say, is much lower, though, than, say, with Amazon FBA or e-commerce business.
I am really happy to hear you say that because we have a strategic initiative within some of our own brands to start pushing out content, as Ken mentioned. And so curious, as you like dive into content type companies, what are some things that you're seeing the very successful content teams doing? And what are some things that you're seeing some content companies doing poorly or not performing well on?
Sure. I'll answer the second part first. So I'm friends with tons of SEOs that build out affiliate websites. And it's very funny to me that they do this and they'll rank on Google for all these like crazy keywords and get all the search volume. And they just kind of forget that there's this thing called marketing that they're supposed to do when the traffic actually hits the website. It's like you have the most valuable traffic in the world. You're doing like nothing. You're like building the next like site to rank, right? So I say that's something a lot of SEOs do wrong or pushing content is they don't understand the true value of their traffic to take it more seriously. The sites are doing it really well, which I think like you kind of are hinting at it that you guys are doing, David, is combining content with more than just the affiliate and display ad monetization. Like you mentioned, something to feed your e-commerce sites. Like we've sold a lot of businesses that do that, and that is powerful. I tell people all the time, like if you can afford it, like you say, you know, your lifestyle is taken care of in terms of expenses and stuff. If you can afford it, always choose building an audience over building revenue, because then that audience just becomes an endless supply of potential stuff for you. Like I have a friend, he had a very big Amazon affiliate site, and he would look at the Amazon associate dashboard of what was selling on his site. And that would be the FBA product he sourced. So his traffic is paying him to do R&D for the product he's going to launch. And if you have this giant content site and building out this email list, which is a thing that most people don't do, but I highly recommend, like if I have this cooking website, like, I don't know, Kitchen Hero, and I have 200,000 people on my email list, and they're all already buying spatulas for me, I say, hey guys, what's your favorite spatula design? I'm about to launch a product. They give me tons of feedback. I launch it on Amazon. Send 200,000 people over to Amazon. What's that going to do with my organic ranking on Amazon? It's going to crush it, right? So I'm a huge fan of building out content sites that don't just do affiliate and display ads. I think it could be much bigger than most people realize.
Yeah, that's awesome. And lots of pro tips there for the audience listening in. We'll just go over them. Capturing the traffic, you want to capture an email. And you want to test the traffic that's coming in on what products they're buying, and use all of that as data to make your useful data to make your decisions with. So excellent nuggets there, Greg.
If you want tips and strategies on how to start, grow, and monetize your business online, check out the Digital Revolution podcast with Eli Adams. We interview digital experts from around the world that share their personal stories. They talk about what they're currently working on and where they see the future going. But most importantly, they share tactics in their specific area of expertise with the hope of helping you improve your digital presence online. You can listen to the Digital Revolution podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, or simply click on the link in the show notes below.
Sorry to interrupt the episode. You may have heard Ken and I talking recently about a new tool that we're using for Amazon refunds. Now, I have used other refund tools like this. However, I can tell you in the first 7 days, they scrubbed the back end of my Amazon account going back 18 months and found $5,000 of refunds. And the nice thing about this is, it's my money. Amazon made a mistake and they are just auditing my account. The other thing I really like about this tool is there is no monthly fee. They only charge a commission if they are successful in getting you your money. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM for Firing the Man, FTM400. This is an awesome tool. Can't say enough good things about it. Now, back to the episode.
As we move along, let's pivot a little bit into Empire Flippers and kind of discuss. So can you discuss, who is Empire Flippers? What do they do there? And then, who do you guys serve and who do you guys help?
Sure. So we help entrepreneurs both on the buy and sell side and investors on the buy and sell side as well to transact, to do the M&A advisory services to help move businesses. So one of the things that we like to view ourselves as is kind of like a consultant for entrepreneurs, because like when you go sell your business, it is an extremely emotional experience. Like it is often 60, 80% of your net worth a lot of the times, or maybe even more. So this is not a decision that is taken lightly. So we help entrepreneurs through all the whole process, even after the process, because there's something that happens after you sell your business that most people would be like, what? No, that doesn't exist. But it totally does, which is where an entrepreneur is like, you know, they get the $3 million, $5 million, whatever it is. And then they're like happy for 5 minutes and then they're super depressed. Like, oh my God, what do I do now? Like they're just like listless because like this was such a big part of their identity. So one of the things we also help entrepreneurs with is like, okay, what are your plans for after selling? Like, if you come onto an exit planning call, we'll be asking you like, why do you want to sell? Like what goal is this getting you closer to help you start dreaming up of those possibilities of what happens? And your life does change a lot when you sell a business because you just go through what I call the doors of possibilities where things open up to you that just never were available to you before because you have so much liquidity. So that's what we do in a nutshell. We help people sell a business, but ultimately we're there for an entrepreneur through like their entire journey, like whether they're, you know, still in the aspirational phase or, you know, they're like some of my friends who are angel investors now who got their initial funding by selling their businesses with us.
Very nice. Very nice. I had a conversation at Prosper this year and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, or how would you counter this? We were talking about selling our businesses and I asked, do you think you're going to go through a broker? And they said, no, I'm not going to because they charge X percent. And I know my business better than anyone else does. So what would be some, and also I'll point out that they had never sold a business. How would you respond to somebody like that?
So this is a super common thing I come across, as you might imagine, right? So I actually have a name for it because I'm a marketer. I like naming everything with cool names. So I call it the off-market fallacy. And on the surface, what that entrepreneur is saying makes total sense. Like, why would you come to EF with, say, a 500K business that they're going to take 15% of? Like, oh my God, like, why are they taking so much, right? But here's the thing, and you mentioned it, David, like they've never done it before. So that's a problem because they only get one shot at it. It's not like a PPC ad campaign where they like have a campaign that failed. Like, okay, I'm going to start up like 20 more this week. But you have one business usually that you can sell. So you don't have a lot of experience with it. And you're going up against people who do have a lot of experience because some of these buyers are buying a couple businesses a week sometimes, you know, like they are getting their reps in. You haven't gone to the gym yet. You don't know where the gym is yet. You haven't sold anything. So the other thing I would say is like, there is this trick. So anyone that's in marketing probably understands this concept of urgency and a scarcity, right? Like, so a thing that buyers will sometimes do is say you have a seven-figure e-commerce business of some sort. They'll offer you a private deal. Hey, here's $1.4 million, but you have like 3 days to accept. So urgency and scarcity. I have one offer, 3 days. Oh my God, I can be a millionaire. That's a lot of money for a bootstrap entrepreneur, right? So like that is tons of pressure. And in their mind, they're thinking like, well, of course I shouldn't go to a broker. I don't want to pay a commission. The buyer's like, that is so smart. You shouldn't do that because we would only only pay a premium, which is their fee. A lot of buyers will say that, which is totally empirically false. I have all the data to prove it. But so the thing is, the buyer agrees with the seller and the seller makes them feel good, like I am making the right decision. And that's where this whole fallacy falls apart, because really the only incentive a buyer has not to use a broker for the most part, and there's a few others, but this is the main one, is to get you for way less than what you're worth, because they know that the broker is going to value you much higher because the broker knows what like the actual going rate valuation is for what you've built. And they're hoping that you don't. And that's the reason why they did this whole private deal in the first place. That's why companies like the aggregators spend literally hundreds of thousands of dollars a month building their own private deal flow, because they don't want you to be on the market. They want you to be off the market so they can get a better deal. Because if you're on the market, there's all this competition that comes in. So that $1.4 million example I said earlier, that's a real story from EF. We ended up selling that guy's business for $2.1 million because he didn't give in to the scarcity. He came to us. We were like, oh, we could sell this for way more. So we did. So he got $1.8 million up front. So $400,000 more than the entirety of the deal of his original offer. And I was just in Dubai speaking at Affiliate World, and I ran to one of my customers. She had a FBA business that she got offered $600,000, same kind of deal with the scarcity, the pressure. She came to us. We sold it for $1.6 million. So did these people pay commission to us? Absolutely. They paid way more than they thought they were going to pay, in fact. But they actually ended up walking away with literally hundreds of thousands of dollars more in their pocket. So that's the off-market fallacy. It's extremely insidious because it sounds so correct as an entrepreneur. But I would highly recommend, whether you use a broker or not, still talk to a broker of some sort. It doesn't have to be us before you sell. Because it is usually your one shot to make a huge, huge exit, right? Unless you have, I guess, like a portfolio of profitable businesses in the side.
That makes a lot of sense. And you know, I remember back in 2019 at the Prosper Show where there was this giant influx of finance bros and operators. We had a lot of finance bros that were very good at raising capital, but not a ton of operators. It was my feeling at that time. And so I'd like to dive into one other kind of piece of a deal, which would be an earnout. And what we've seen some examples, and we actually have friends of the podcast who have sold a large component of that overall deal value was tied up in an earnout. So first, can you explain to our listeners what is an earnout and then what to be on the lookout for if they're selling and that's a component of the deal?
Sure. So an earnout is very, very common. If you have a relatively larger business, I'd say anything above $1 million for sure, you are probably going to have an earnout of some components. So basically what it is, like, let's say I have a $2 million business, a buyer gives me an offer, they'll pay me $1.6 million upfront. So that's money into my pocket right away. And then the remainder $400,000 is going to be in either, it's probably going to be in both of these things. So earnout or in a stabilization payment. Those are the two most common things in deal structures of this size. And the earnouts, like, let's say it's $200,000 is in that earnout. I am telling you, I will pay you $200,000 if your business either keeps growing at this pace and we get to this point. I will pay you that $200,000, say, over a course of 6 months or a year. Sometimes it can be longer, but it's not usually too much longer than a year. Stabilization payment, very similar concept as earnout, but it just has to stay pretty much the exact same as what the buyer bought it at, hence the stabilization. One thing to watch out for on earnouts is make sure you trust the person that is giving you the earnout. So there is this other very sneaky move that the finance pros can do. It's not something I've seen often. I've seen it once on our marketplace for sure. I think it probably has happened a few times. We saved the seller because the seller was over the moon. One of these aggregators who gave them this earnout, like, oh, I'm going to make so much money, because sometimes the earnout could be where they pay you over the list price. So more than the $2 million if your business does really, really well. So in the seller's mind, like, man, I'm going to make tons of extra money here. Of course I want to do it. But our team looked at the earnout like, wait a second, this earnout is very unrealistic. It's saying like your business needs to grow like way up here. They're like, your business, even if it kills it, will be like here. So they did that earnout specifically as a way to mitigate their capital risk, because they knew like, hey, this business is not going to hit that. So why don't we save that 200K or whatever it was and on that particular deal? Because they also knew like this probably won't hit. This is what I mean by buyers and sellers having this skill gap in this space. Just because sellers don't do it as often. So that's one thing to watch out. Make sure that the person giving you the earnout is someone you really trust.
Yeah, excellent. And one little follow-up piece there on an earnout is, and something that David and I have heard, has happened a few times, was the deal in the deal structure, and the earnout was you hit this number and then the earnout is paid fully, but nothing on the reverse. Like if you make 95% or 90%, it's nothing. And so ensuring that in the deal to make sure you have it tapered, you know, if you hit 90, you get this pot or not 80, 70. And so that structure is way better for the seller than the buyer. So awesome. Now, a lot of these, I kind of want to take a step back and I like that term off-market fallacy. I like that. That's pretty good. I'll remember that one. And just to touch on that piece you mentioned, like, cause David and I'm sure anybody that has FBA business, gets hammered with emails from aggregators, not as much in the last few months, but maybe last year hammered with emails about, hey, you know, let's talk. And then you're right, Greg, they throw out, you know, they look at it, they throw out an offer, which to anybody that's not going to market, seeing a big number come in your inbox, you're like, oh, wow. But you have 3 days, right? You can't legitimately take it 3 days and go to, you know, yourself, your team, Empire Flippers, and say, hey, I got this offer. You know, can you do an evaluation? It's not going to happen in 3 days, right? And so they know they've got you in kind of a squeeze play. And so definitely a good note to watch out for in terms of like what the buyer strategy, you know, if you're a seller, you definitely want to understand what the buyer strategy is in that scarcity model. So really like that. David or Greg, any other topics that we want to cover before we head into the fire round?
I've got one more question for you. And then Greg, I want to circle back on what you were going to say. So to the people that do sell and that they're experiencing this lull post selling, what would you recommend that they do? And the two kind of things that I would think is, you know, buy another smaller established FBA business, or perhaps start a new FBA business from scratch, or going to something else. But what would you know, of your friends that you've seen that have sold, where have you seen them take their dollars and put them to work and get a good ROI on that and also, you know, enjoy it?
Yeah. So what I always advise entrepreneurs on, and usually I say this because someone asked me like, Greg, how do I time the market? Like, okay, I'm going to teach you how to time the market for like the best multiple. The answer is don't do it because you can't. I tell people like the real way to sell is always based on your personal and business goals, right? Like that's the dichotomy. Like every reason I've seen under the sun of why to sell is in those two categories, right? So when you go to sell, like ask yourself before you sell, like, why am I selling? What goal do I have? Does this get me closer to either, you know, my personal life? Like maybe I'll be like debt free or like travel the world or whatever, right? Like yeah, there's some benefit there for my personal life and the business life as well. Like now I can buy, you know, invest in real estate or buy another business of what you just said, David. So that's the first part, is have a plan. As far as what my friends have done, so this is something that's kind of interesting that came to me. And of course I gave it a name, just like the off-market fallacy. I saw it happen over and over again on the marketplace. I think I came up with this idea like two and a half years ago. And I call it the asset flywheel. So it's basically where someone sells a business, then they take that capital and they buy, say, two smaller businesses from us. Usually it's in the exact same business model of what they just sold. And that business is just like kind of more early stages of what they had built. So they already have this roadmap of what to do next. They build up that business and then they sell that business with us again. Then they buy, say, two, three more of those businesses and they keep doing this. I have a friend who did this with affiliate websites, and he ended up over a period of 2 years, he ended up selling like $700,000 or $800,000 worth of businesses for us. And then he used that $700,000 or $800,000 to go buy like a SaaS business. He started a technology service company. And then both in really competitive spaces, the SaaS didn't work out, but the technology service did. And because he had $600,000-$700,000, he was able to just crush it. I've seen people do much bigger numbers than him now. He was one of my friends early on in my career. I still talk to him actually quite a bit. But yeah, so that's something I see a lot of sellers do. Like I've seen people basically become financially free over like what I call the five-year wealth plan of doing that asset flywheel. Now, I don't recommend putting all of your money back into online businesses, because one of the big benefits of selling a business is you get divorced from the algorithms, right? You're divorced from Amazon policy updates, Google updates, whatever. And you should take some of that money off the table to reward yourself for the hard work, maybe invest it in something less risky than an online business. But if you want real hardcore growth, there's nothing better than buying a business. I think it's way faster than building a business from scratch, and in a lot of ways, way safer, because you already have that proven market fit. So that's what I recommend and what I've seen my friends do.
If you're a podcast host or someone wanting to be interviewed on podcasts as a guest, visit podmatch.com. Podmatch automatically connects ideal podcast guests and hosts together for interviews. We always say it works just like a dating app, but instead of connecting you for dates, it connects you for podcast interviews. Podmatch has connected over 85,000 guests and hosts together for interviews that listeners love, all while saving you countless hours of administrative work through built-in automations. If you're ready to level up your podcast interviews on either side of the mic, start today by visiting podmatch.com.
All right, very good. And then right before I had asked that question, you had another thing. So let's circle back on what that was.
Oh man, I was thinking in my head like, oh God, I'm going to forget what it was. So it was something that Ken said about the emails. There was some other story that I think was about the aggregators. Maybe it'll come back to me, but it was some nugget of wisdom that I thought would be good for the audience. I don't remember what it was now.
No worry. I do have one quick a follow-up, Greg. And so maybe whatever you had, it might pop in there as we're going through this one. So I really like that advice. You know, when exiting, the entrepreneur takes a good chunk of that and then buys into some other smaller businesses in that same space. And so I noticed you definitely hinted and made sure it's the same space. And so do you ever recommend, like you mentioned, like one of your friends had bought several businesses in multiple other spaces. And so can you talk to like why you recommend that and what you've seen before? Is that not a good strategy or what?
Sure. So to be clear, when I say a similar space, I don't mean the exact same niche, because if you sold a business, you probably sold a non-compete. I mean business models. So one of the things entrepreneurs sometimes think of is like buying a business is like index funds. I should diversify with different models. Like I even have friends who say like, I want to have some FBA exposure and affiliate exposure. This is a really bad idea for the most part, because unless you have a big team, they're totally different business models and they're ran completely different. So I wouldn't really recommend that. Now, if you grow up with doing both, that's great. You have the skill set. But when you're first starting out, I always recommend, like when you first sell a business and you first start buying businesses with that new capital, I always recommend buying what you know first before you go off and explore something else. So that's what I meant by that. I actually have another friend. They spent like, I want to say it's like $1.4 or $1.8 million buying a bunch of different businesses, like small businesses and different business models. It was terrible. Like it did not go well for him. We told him, you should not do this. And like, you don't know. Like, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. And one quick follow-up about, I'll kick it over to David. So with your experience in helping sellers, what are like maybe the top one or two things that you've seen? So, cause for me, motivation is huge. And so when I hear of like these great stories of people exiting and what they're doing afterwards. And so what are a couple things that some of your sellers have done that's like super cool, or like, you know, they traveled around the world for a year, or, you know, anything come to mind?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many cool stories. And on the buy side too, there's a lot of cool stories. There's this one buyer I always think of in particular. They used to be like high level media executives, and they had a child that had some kind of mental learning disability or something like that. And the school was like an hour away from their house, but the commute to their job was like another 2 hours the opposite direction. So by the time they got like their kid back home and stuff, they had like no time at all, because the kid had to go to a special school for their condition. And so they bought this business from us, and they ended up just like moving like 5 minutes next to that school and quitting their job. Like I think it took them like 6 or 8 months once they bought the business to do that. But that is super cool. And likewise, I on a seller side, so I live in Asia, right? I live in Southeast Asia. I've helped this Vietnamese guy in Hanoi. So I live in Ho Chi Minh City. He lives in Hanoi. He sold an affiliate website with us for like, I think it was like $250,000, something around that number. So my wife and I, we went up to Hanoi and like, you know, hit him up, like to talk to him. And like, this guy is like full-blown Vietnamese. So like, you can live very cheaply in Vietnam, right? So $250,000, like as an American, that's a big payday. For a Vietnamese, that's like potentially generational income, you know, like that could be huge. And this guy spoke no English, absolutely none. How we communicated was his friend, she happened to be a professor of English at Hanoi. She was this other Vietnamese lady. So to meet up with her for coffee, he brought her. So like, all right, I'll buy coffee for her too. So like our whole conversation was just like through the lens of her translating. And I asked him like, well, how did you build this site? Because he was selling to Americans. He was like, well, Filipinos speak really good English, so I hired them to do it. I trusted them that it was good. And then I would have my professor friend like look at them look at the content like every other month. I'm like, that is awesome. You know, like, that's one of the things I love about entrepreneurs, is just like that scrappiness. Like, well, this seems hard, so I guess I'll figure it out. Like, instead of just like giving up, like, how do I do this? So a lot of cool stories like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. That is a cool story. That's a kind of no excuses type of story, right? Where when someone's always has these excuses, you're like, hey, this person here didn't even speak English, built right. a business and sold it, you know? So that's pretty cool. Awesome. David, anything else, or Greg, anything else before we get into the fire round?
Nope.
All right. Greg, are you ready?
I'm ready. Fire it up.
All right. What is your favorite book?
My favorite fiction book is Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. He's the guy who wrote No Country for Old Men and The Road. Those are the two famous movie adaptations. Favorite business book is probably Richest Man in Babylon. I think that's just a great parable, personal finance.
Awesome. Very cool. Yeah, I haven't heard of the first one, but the second one I read. I'm going to put the first one on my list. What are your hobbies?
Well, if my first answer didn't give it away, I'm a big literature nerd. So I write novels for fun. That's one of my big hobbies. I also have this weird penchant for loving to troll other internet marketers. So I did this thing at a conference. It was this SEO conference, and I knew one of my main competitors was coming. And to like get to the conference, there was this billboard that you have to pass by. And I was speaking at the conference, so I told my second command at the time, like, hey, I need you to figure out how much this billboard's going to cost us. He said, what? Like, figure it out. So he did. And it was just like, it was in Thailand. And so we bought this billboard. Said, welcome to Chiang Mai. Get a business valuation from Empire Flippers. All the tours like, what is this? Why is this on a billboard? And all the internet marketers were like taking pictures of it. And you can just see my competitor like passing through this, like, ah. And so I was like on stage speaking. And I said, I'm going to teach you the secrets to making money on the internet. I went to the next slide. There's a picture of the billboard. Billboard advertising. I told everyone to go take videos with the billboard. So it led to all this like hilarious drunk SEOs like taking videos with the EF billboard. My competitor thought it was pretty hilarious.
That's awesome. That's like a next level trolling right there.
Yeah. I thought I bought it for like a month. It turned out I bought it for like 3 months. I have a lot of friends who live in Chiang Mai. Like, when is this coming down? They're like sending me messages like, I guess it's really cheap to buy a billboard in Thailand. I had no idea.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. Any deal flow come through?
Yeah, actually, funny enough, from the UGC, the user generated content of people like talking, like hanging out with the billboards. And when digital nomads would like go into Chiang Mai, sometimes they would post like on Instagram, like, this really is the capital of digital nomads. There's an Empire Flippers advertisement right here. You know, so
that's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you got deal flow and you got to troll your competitors. Yeah. So you can't beat
it's
that.
It's the best. You know, you're marketing to internet marketers who are jaded against internet marketers. So why not be a bit weird, break the frame a bit, have some fun, you know? This is going to be boring, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. The last one here. What do you think sets apart successful entrepreneurs from those who give up, fail, or never get started?
I think the major difference is successful people fail a lot more than the people who give up. They keep failing over and over again. I spent 10 years learning internet marketing since I was like 18. I failed tons and tons of times. You just got to keep failing. The faster you fail, probably the faster you find success too. But most people give up at the first few fails and they're like, I'm never doing that again. That sucked.
Excellent. Yep. Awesome. So, David, you want to close out the show?
Yeah. So, Greg, if people are interested in connecting with Empire Flippers, what would be the best way?
Sure. Yeah. You just go to empireflippers.com. You can check our evaluation tool as well. If you want to connect with me personally, it's just greg@empireflippers.com, or you can add me on LinkedIn or Facebook. I'm usually pretty easy to get a hold of and always happy to help, whether as, you know, a question with marketing or EF or whatever. Happy to help.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the Firing the Man podcast, and we're looking forward to staying in touch.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to today's Firing the Man podcast. If you like this episode, head on over to firingtheman.com and check out our resource library for exclusive Firing the Man discounts on popular e-commerce subscription services. That is firingtheman.com/resource. You can also find a comprehensive library of over 50 books that Ken and I have read in the last few years that have made a meaningful impact on our business. For that, head on over to www.firingtheman.com/library. Lastly, check us out on social media at Firing the Man and on YouTube at Firing the Man for exclusive content. This is David Schomer
and Ken Wilson.
We're out. Before you go, we wanted to share a new service that Ken and I have been using called Getida that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A.com, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for Firing the Man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?